Hello and welcome to NextPod, VP NextGen's podcast made for veterinary students and young professionals who want to know what's next. I'm your host, Sarah Sed, and today we will be talking about life as a Native American veterinarian, and here to share her experiences is Dr. Talani Francisco from Native Healing, a veterinary practice and wellness center in Laguna, New Mexico. Welcome, Dr. Talani.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate being invited on this morning.
Yeah, I'm so happy to have you here. I just really want to ask you a bit more about yourself before we get started. So kind of what university / college did you attend, and how did you kind of, what made you want to become a veterinarian to where you are today?
Well, we'll start with how I wanted to become a veterinarian. I was a little reservation girl, you know, growing up. I was born on the Navajo Nation out in Northern Arizona. But I spent my whole life on reservations. I'm from the Pueblo of Laguna, which is in north central New Mexico, and would spend every summer there with my grandparents in our village of Powati. My father was with the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and so we were always on a reservation because he was in education. And so I grew up on the Navajo, White Mountain Apache. Then we spent a year actually living in Las Cruces, New Mexico. That was the only time I lived in a city. And then we lived in Mississippi on the Mississippi Band of Choctaw Reservation for about 2.5, almost 3 years. My mother is from the Catawba Nation in South Carolina. And so we would spend time in Catawba on her reservation every summer as well. So my whole life, I just, you know, I was a res rat, as we call ourselves. But somebody once told me I was a BIA baby. So one summer, I think I was about 15 years old, we were helping one of my great uncles shear sheep. The shearers had come up from southern New Mexico, and they came up in this old ratty bus, and you know, they were all Spanish-speaking gentlemen, and they were, you know, they were shearing the sheep. And there was a moment when my grandmother yelled at me, "Giao, giao, honey, you know, come with me." And she grabbed me, and I was running with her because this ewe had been gutted by one of those shearers. He caught her umbilical, you know, cord, or her umbilical navel area with that clipper and just pulled it upward. And so this ewe was her, you know, her guts were coming out. I mean, she was eviscerated right there. And I apologize for my barking dogs. I do not know what's making them bark today. So this ewe was being, you know, her guts were hanging out, her rumen. And my grandmother just grabbed me, and we ran over there. And just as fast as she could, she slit the ewe's throat, and she had a bucket right there for me to catch the blood and everything. And it was just this like massive organized chaos. And I think that was the moment when I really, really knew that I wanted to become a veterinarian, because I honestly felt that, gosh, if I'd been a veterinarian, maybe I could have saved that ewe's life. But I've always had a fondness for animals. My parents will tell you, growing up, I was the kid who brought every animal into the house, and I used to bring the little bum lambs in, and my mother would get after me. She's like, "You can't keep them in the house. They stink," and all this stuff. So I think it was kind of, it was just one of those things that was destined. It was kind of destiny.
Yeah. It's so funny. It never ceases to amaze me. I think most vets that I ever speak to that I ask that question to say pretty much the same kind of thing, where they just knew that when they were so young, it just came to them. It wasn't even a question in their minds. It's pretty incredible.
Yeah, it, you know, I feel very kind of blessed. My dad tells me that it, for him, he sees it as a calling, almost as something that when I was a little girl, there was a time, I guess, in our culture, if you have any association with a lightning strike, or have, you know, experienced one and survived it or anything like that, it's seen as a calling. And in Laguna, we call them Jayanis, you know, the medicine healers. And I guess when I was an infant, one time when my parents were out on the reservation, a lightning bolt struck very near the car that that we were in. And my dad says that nowadays, he goes, I guess that was you receiving your calling as a Jayani for the animals.
Oh, wow. I love that. And would you actually mind explaining a little bit more about your culture and kind of what it was like growing up on a reservation?
I didn't know any different. So I am mixed blood. My father is from the Pueblo of Laguna, and Pueblo culture, especially with the Lagunas, but you know, all 19, well, now there's 20 Pueblo tribes. But the Pueblo culture is that you become what your father is. So in my case, my father was from Laguna. My mother is half Anglo and half Catawba, but she came to live at Laguna with dad and kind of has been accepted for the most part. But so we took my father's tribe as our tribe. And so that's very common with the Pueblo people. It's getting less practiced, I think, as people, you know, we're all getting kind of mixed blood and stuff like that. But as a little Pueblo girl, I had the responsibility to help my grandparents when I lived with them in their little adobe house, to feed and water the animals in the morning. So we had horses. Occasionally we'd have a cow in a corral up on the outside of the village. And so I'd go with my grandfather up there in the morning, and we'd take water because we didn't have running water at our corral. I'd help him in the afternoon, or we would bring the horses to the center of the village for them to water at the water trough. So it was just, you know, I guess it was a very simple life. We irrigated our fields. My grandfather always had about a half to three quarter acre garden right there in the village. And so when we would ask the Mayoromos for water, you know, it was a big deal because you got the water. And living down here in the desert land, water is life. And so, it was a very simple life. We didn't sit around watching TV because we didn't have a TV. But, you know, at first I still remember growing up having to use an outhouse because we didn't have sewer in my grandparents' house until can't remember, I was probably 6 or 7 years old. So I remember fighting with the boys running across the road and, you know, across our yard and everything to go to the outhouse. So yeah. I had four cousins, male cousins, when I was growing up. Three male cousins and my brother, and we were all kind of just raised as brothers and sister. And then finally later, about 6 years later, when I was my aunt finally had another little girl, but we were so far apart in age that I didn't get to spend too much time with her. So I grew up an incredible tomboy.
Mm-hmm. That sounds like such a nice childhood. And what was the moment like for you where you thought, okay, I'm going to apply to vet school, I'm going to get in, I'm going to do this for real?
Well, I went to New Mexico State University because you were asking about my education. So I graduated from a reservation high school, Laguna Acoma High School, there on my reservation. And then I went to New Mexico State for undergrad. And it's kind of funny because I was valedictorian in my high school and people go, oh, she was so smart. And I kind of go, well, you know, it wasn't that I was smart because I'm not smart, but I'm very, I persevere. I'm just one of those people that learning is difficult for me. Learning was hard, but I had family who really supported me. And my father used to push me, you know, he had me reading Shakespeare and all kinds of stuff already when I was young, because he wanted me to be well-rounded. So I went to New Mexico State, didn't have a car, had a 3-speed bicycle, and lived in the dormitories, you know, no television. We were poor. That was what college students did, was you learned that, you know, you're on your own. So in my third year at New Mexico State, I started applying for veterinary schools. And at the time, New Mexico, we still don't have a veterinary school here, but we had an agreement with Colorado State University. So that it was called the Witchy program. And I don't know if it's still in play. I think it might be, where you go to that university as an in-state student. So you get in-state tuition, but you make the agreement that you will come back to your state. So in this case, I would come back to New Mexico and I would work here to pay off my debt for having in-state tuition in Colorado. And Colorado State was well known for their equine sciences and their equine program. And I am typical res girl. I've loved horses since my father put me on one at 2 days of age. I have always loved horses. And so that was my intent. I'm going to go to Colorado State. Well, I had been working in the summers for a veterinarian in Corrales, New Mexico. And both of the veterinarians at that practice were Kansas State graduates. And my father and my grandfather had really always used Kansas State graduates for our cattle work and our horses and our sheep, large animal work. And they were all dead set. They were like, you are going to Kansas State. And I was doing the opposite, going, no, I want to apply to Colorado State. So I put my application. At that time, you had to apply to each university individually. I understand the process is quite different nowadays, but you had to apply directly to that college, and you had to have letters from veterinarians to support you and to validate that you had your 600 hours of veterinary experience working with them. So I had done that. I'd been working with these two veterinarians, and I gave them my application package and asked them to take a look at it and see what, you know, if they could get me my letters of recommendation for Colorado State. And they did. And so Christmas time rolled around and we all went home, and, you know, my classmates and fellow colleagues that were down, we were all, you know, undergrads. We're all kind of just wondering, gosh, am I going to get my letter to, you know, to get an interview at vet school and all this and that. And so we came back in January and I had two letters waiting on me, one from Kansas State and one from Colorado State. The letter from Kansas State told me that they were inviting me to come view their school, but I had already been accepted. And I said, that's odd, because I didn't even apply there and I didn't know what happened. Then I got a letter from Colorado State that told me I had an interview and the date of the interview and all this. So I called my parents, and this is in the time when we still had collect phone calls. So I went down to the bottom, to the area where we had phones in the dormitory, called my parents collect and said, I got in at Kansas State, but they want me to come visit. I said, I didn't even apply there. And my dad started laughing and he goes, oh, you did. You just didn't know you did. So what had happened was the two veterinarians and my parents had all concocted that they took a copy of my application from Colorado State and they sent it to Kansas State with such strong, I guess, recommendation that Kansas State said, yeah, we definitely want to have this young lady. So long story short, I went, visited both schools. Fell in love at Kansas State. It was a relatively new veterinary school that they had just transferred out of the old buildings into a new building. And more than anything else, I still remember one of the professors. My parents drove up there in the middle of a snowstorm because they wanted to see the school as well. And they were told, your daughter is not just going to college here. She's becoming part of a family. And to this day, I will tell you, I never regretted going to Kansas State. I did. I joined a family when I went to Kansas State, and I feel very honored.
Wow. What a story. I feel like that just is very one of those, it was always meant to be kind of stories.
Yeah.
That's awesome. And I read on your website, you know, that you're only the second Native American woman to obtain her DVM.
I think I might be the third. I know that there is, I think her name was Evelyn Connolly. She's Blackfeet from Montana. And I think she might have graduated in 1989. I knew there was a lady in the early 80s who graduated from Oklahoma State. And I think she may have been Choctaw, one of the Oklahoma tribes. I worked with her for a short time when I was with the USDA. Initially. And at the time when I came out, like in 1990, that was it. That was the three of us. That was it.
Wow, that's incredible. And so what does that mean to you to be within that group of women?
Well, I'm honored that I'm one of the first ones that had the tenacity to just do it. And I still remember I had a high school counselor. I was not, and am not a, you know, a pretty woman like you, you know, I never ran in a beauty contest or anything like that. Never had boyfriends growing up because, you know, to begin with, I was Talani Francisco and everybody knew that I was Tony and Gertrude's granddaughter and Eldon and Shirley's daughter. And that just, they were like, hands off, you just leave her alone. her family's very intense. They knew that I was going to go to school, but I had this guidance counselor that told me, you know, Talani, you're smart. You're smart enough. But you're not pretty. You know what? You should probably just hope that the best thing you could do is find a good man and get married and have babies.
That's wild. Wow.
Yeah. And I always remember that. And I remember going home after that conversation with that counselor. And my father was like, well, having babies is not bad. But, you know, he had already had the conversation with me. My father has a degenerative retinal disease that's hereditary, and he's, you know, he's a carrier. And so we knew that I was carrying the gene. And he had already talked to me about not having children, especially with another person from my tribe, because retinitis pigmentosa is so prevalent in our tribe. And my father told me, he said, Talani, he said, I would feel really, really bad if you had a child and I, as their grandfather, knew that I gave them their blindness. And so he told me, he said, you know, if you want to get married and have kids, that's fine, but do it with somebody that is not from Laguna so that, you know, we spread out the genetics, or just adopt children. And I was like, okay, I can do that.
Yeah. And in terms of your time at veterinary school, how do you think it is different now as compared to for you when it comes to opportunities for Native American people?
Oh, I think it's wide open. I talk to so many students now that are Native that are going to school, and it's quite a bit different. You know, when I was at Kansas State, I think there were two of us that were Native. There was a gentleman in my class, Stan Jones, who was from one of the Sioux tribes in one of the Dakotas. I think it's South Dakota. But he had grown up in the city and very detached from, you know, he was like, I've never even been on the reservation. You know, he didn't speak his language or anything. And I grew up very traditional with, you know, a family that practiced our belief and did everything the way we did. And so we were very, very different. But I look at the kids nowadays, and I see this in general. Our younger generation do not speak their languages. And that's really tough. That's really, really tough. My father and my grandfather used to always tell us that we were not Indian unless we spoke our language, because that is what identified us. So I see the kids nowadays kind of meshing things and, you know, doing Indian rap. And I see tribes that were not powwow tribes, like, you know, many of our Laguna, our Pueblo nations, our Pueblo tribes that are doing powwows, and they've adopted practices from other tribes. And then the kids go to college and they adapt new things. And it's, I guess I'm seeing that evolution that we always talk about. And it's hard, it's difficult, especially when I grew up in a very traditional setting and knew about my ancestors and bringing my ancestors and taking my ancestors with me.
Yeah. And you opened a practice/wellness center. I was wondering if you could tell me a bit more about that, and why specifically did you want your clinic to also be a wellness center as well as you know, somewhere that animals can be just treated for medical purposes.
Right. So I like I said, I've been out of veterinary school since 1990, and my career has been very different than the traditional veterinary career. I went into private practice in Reno, Nevada in 1990. And in 1992, the summer of 1992, I had a pretty significant injury. I had a wild horse rupture my appendix, and I had to have emergency surgery and all this. But then after I recovered that fall, my father was, you know, telling me, he said, I think maybe you need to find a practice where you only work on like parakeets or little birds or something that won't hurt you as bad. And so I got into federal regulatory medicine with the USDA APHIS. And that's a large part of what I've done. I went into the Air Force post 9/11. I spent some time in Bolivia before 9/11. So I've done a lot of other like non-traditional clinic things, but I would always come home to Laguna, wherever I was living, and work on the family animals. You know, extended family would bring me their cat, their dog, their horse, their pig, their goat, their sheep, whatever. And so I would just work out of mom and dad's garage. But so I've always like dabbled in clinical medicine. Well, when I was on active duty in the Air Force, I got a master's degree in public health. And I specialized, or I guess I centered on community health, because I knew all along that I wanted to go back to Laguna. It had always been my dream to not work out of my parents' garage, but to actually open up a nice clinic. And it's very, very expensive. Oh my goodness, I had no idea until I started trying to do it how expensive it was. So I went the other route. And when I came back to New Mexico in 2017, I decided, you know what, it's time. It's time for me to do what I've always wanted to do. So I got a business license, and I was still working out of my mom and dad's garage, and things just kind of fell into place. And now I have a 20 by 30 Quonset hut that has heating and air conditioning and insulation. And we have space for about 15 animals in crates, you know, and we have two surgery tables, and we have a little digital x-ray, and we've got some limited laboratory diagnostics. But we do, you know, we have our equipment's old, but it's operable, and we can give good care. And so it was one of those things that I just always knew, this is what I always want to do.
Yeah. And tell me more about your ambition. I also read this on your website, about your ambition to open these wellness centers on reservations just across the U.S.
Yeah. So I found my little Quonset hut. It came out of Canada. It had a gentleman that, you know, had two of them for sale, and at a very reasonable price, $8,500. And I was like, oh my, all, yes, I'll take it. And I searched and searched how, and one day I just kind of got this idea for how to insulate the building. Cause you know, a Quonset hut it's rounded. And so you have pony walls on the side and, you know, 12-foot center beam, but it's all open. And so you can do what you want. And I got to thinking, I said, you know what, for $8,500 and about another, $1,000, maybe $1,500, I got the insulation in there. And if you had a good electrician, I used my husband, he learned to be an electrician. You could put up a little clinic like this, not fancy. You can build your walls. We have nice walls that look like shiplap, you know, from the Magnolia Lady in Texas. But we look pretty good. You know, we're wanting to pour that enamel epoxy on the floor and kind of make it, you know, look really nice, but we're in there, we're operational. I have been very lucky to get donated equipment from the U.S. military when installations were being closed and veterinary clinics were closing. So I have the stainless steel crates and exam table and surgery tables. And as other practices get new equipment, more updated stuff. I am able to get very operational equipment and use it. We have two autoclaves because I believe I'm going to do it right. We do surgeries with our gowns and masks and everything, you know, just as though you were in a clinic. But I got to thinking, part of what Native healing is about, it's healing our Native people, because we all believe that the two-legged, the finned, the feathered, they're the creeping and crawlings, they're all our relations. And so we, as the two-leggeds, have a responsibility to help them as much as we can. And so I thought, you know what? I could do my little Quonset huts on reservation lands all over the United States, especially in places like my Laguna, that's a little bit far out. We got a lot of people on my reservation that don't have cars, that don't have any access to get their animals into town, and now everybody has DirecTV or Dish Network or some streaming device, you know, Hulu or Netflix or whatever. And so they watch Dr. Pohl and they watch, you know, Pet ER, whatever. And they see these things and they kind of feel bad because they're like, I can't do that for my animal. And I thought, you know what, if we could put these little clinics up, especially in our rural reservation settings, doesn't have to be fancy, but it has to be operational. It has to be good. And people have to have a respect for that so that they don't come and, you know, break in and try to steal your drugs and stuff like that. But how great would that be that then we could be giving back to our brothers and sisters that are non-speaking, that, you know, that are the finned and the feathered, the four-legged, the furred, all of them, and really get back to what Creator intended us to be as true, you know, co-inhabitants of this planet.
Yeah. And what is the importance, based on your experience and your opinion, what is the importance of the human-animal bond, particularly within the Native communities?
Oh, I think it's very, very important. I mean, we see them as they are. They're our kinsmen. They're our equals in some respects. But yet on the other hand, I know a lot of people say, oh, but you hunt and you fish and you eat them. How can you do that? And I said, because I was taught that Creator put them here to help us survive. Because without them, we would not have our food, we would not have our fiber, our clothing, you know. And so when you look at it, every part of your life is affected by some animal in some way. And even the car you drive, because all that plastic and the petroleum, it came from those dinosaurs that, you know, they were our relations as well. And so I think it's very, very healthy for people to understand that when you own an animal, you have a responsibility. It's a very, very important responsibility, much like having a two-legged, you know, little one that you are trying to nurture and make them into a good citizen. The same thing for the four-legged. I feel really bad because sometimes I have to put animals down that just, I mean, they've attacked somebody. They've done a lot of damage. They may kill other creatures, whether they're killing livestock, or unfortunately, we've had some humans attacked by the dogs. And you have to, you know, have everything has to be in a balance. And I that's why I think that human animal bond is very, very important. Owning an animal is more than buying a bag of dog food and setting it outside and saying, yeah, I feed the dogs. There's so much more to it.
Yeah. And what would be your advice for people who want to support Native American veterinary professionals and communities? What can they do to help?
Well, they can always volunteer. There are a number of volunteer organizations. I have been speaking recently with different groups that go out to tribal lands. Then there's just financial, because everybody knows, you know, it's difficult to provide a lot of care at a high quality for nothing. And I see that on tribal lands a lot, where people, you know, come in and they say, God, I went into Albuquerque and to spay my dog and update it on shots and check it for heartworms. I'm looking at $1,000. And I'm like, yeah, yeah, it's expensive. I have to buy those things and use them. But, you know, if you can donate something, some cash amount that will help so that we can go forward and we can keep doing this and try to be very responsible on our purchasing and really looking at things, I think that's important. I want people to understand that, you know, we're not begging people for, you know, alms for the poor, if you will, but we're asking people to help us so that we can help ourselves. And one thing that is really important to me, and one of my best friends volunteers and goes to Africa a lot. She goes down into Central and South America doing veterinary mission programs. But not everybody can afford that. Not everybody has a passport. And so I want to, you know, tell those folks that are out there that want to make a difference, go volunteer on a reservation. You know what? Our Native people need that help. And there's so much you can do, so much from not just doing spays and neuters, but talking about nutrition. And not everybody can afford Royal Canin and Purina. You know, some people have to feed the lesser quality dog foods, but we can educate and we can help build shelters, and we can help people get to spay neuter programs and things like that. And ticks, oh my goodness, the parasites. Yeah, we can talk about that. We can provide tick prevention, flea and tick control, you know, for both large and small animals. There's so many ways that people can be active in that.
And what would be your advice to Native Americans who are hoping to follow in your footsteps career-wise, who'd love to be veterinarians or work in the vet field?
My first thing that I always tell kids is I hope that you do not get discouraged. There will be a lot of discouraging times. Do not expect to make a lot of money. You have to be happy doing what you're doing and feeling like you're making a difference, and just really, I guess, kind of being at peace with yourself and where you're at. Don't get discouraged. You're going to make bad grades. You're going to flunk tests. You're going to be told that you were the worst veterinarian on the planet. You know what? I learned this in vet school. I'm a duck. I'm a duck. I'm a duck. And all those nasty, bad things that people say and do, whatever, to me, they roll off my back like water. And so in those tough times, I try to remember myself and the people that I have had lifting me up. It helps to have a great support group of people that you can just reach out to just talk to. And I have been blessed to have friends and family that I could always go back to and cry on their shoulder. And they, you know, they would listen to me and then they would say, okay, but you still need to go forward and don't give up.
Yeah. I love that duck analogy. Like, it's such a good visual, that, you know, picturing a duck swimming and kind of just free of all the droplets of water.
Yes. Yes. Just let all that negativity just roll off your back, but also learn from it. Learn that those people exist in the world and we have to deal with them. We have to work with them. But don't let them pull you down.
Yeah. And thank you so much, Dr. Talani, for, you know, taking the time to share your advice and your experiences with our listeners. So we end every podcast with just a short Q&A, just really quick question, answer that showcases you pretty much. So my first question for you is, what is your ultimate career goal as of now?
My ultimate career goal now is to retire. I've been at this for 32 years. I figure I probably have another 15 maybe, and then I want to kick back and I want to be able to just see that I've made a difference in the world.
I kind of love that, because I think, you know, oftentimes this is something that I've been told, that veterinarians are, you know, how many people, they have their career and then they have their personal lives and their identity is not necessarily based on their career. A lot of times people say in the vet industry that being a vet is so tied to their identity that it is so hard to stop, you know, as they get older, to stop working. Mm-hmm. And I kind of love that you said that you want to retire, not because there's anything obviously wrong with working, but just because, you know, it's okay to take a next step in your life and to do whatever it is you want to do afterwards.
Exactly. Exactly. And just to enjoy life, enjoy your family, have those relationships. You know, I have classmates now that have grandkids And, you know, and I don't have any children, but I love just being able to work with the youth and just trying to see that next generation and just trying to help them move forward.
Yeah, for sure. Do you have a quote or a philosophy that you live by that kind of helps you get through the day?
I do. And this goes back to, it can go several different ways, but I learned it as a young girl. I was reading a book about a football player. His name was Gail Sayers and Brian Piccolo. They were, this is way back in the 60s, I think early 70s. But one of them had cancer, and he was helping his friend, and just, you know, this story about of these two men helping each other. And quote that I live by is came from this gentleman, and I live by it. But God is first, the Lord is first, my family and friends are second, and I am third. I always try to go in that manner, that I think of our Creator first. I try to do everything that Creator wants me to do. Then I look after my friends and my family, and that includes my four-legged family. And then I am third. I come in third. But because if I look after everybody else and I try to always do that, I know that I will be okay.
Wow. That's a good one. and who inspires you to continue to make a change within the industry?
Probably my dad. My dad is 81 years old. He's non-visual. He just had a brain tumor removed last fall. He's making a remarkable recovery. So he's been living with me, and I've been helping him on his rehabilitation. But every day we talk about, what can I do better in the next day? What can I strive for? And he always tries to keep me very grounded, and just, you know, Talani, make a difference. Always try to help those that need your help. Don't be pushy. He's always telling me that. Don't be pushy. But just try to make the world a better place.
Oh, wow. That's incredible. And thank you. Like, my last question is just really, where can people find you, you know, email or social media, website, kind of that stuff?
Yeah. So you can learn about me and see pictures of our little Quonset and how we put it up and all of that at our website is Native Healing LLC. And then if you type Veterinarians Laguna, New Mexico, you can find us there as well. I'm on Facebook. I get a lot of people that, you know, hit me up on Facebook, and a lot of times I won't friend them because I don't know who they are, but you can always send me a message on Facebook. And I think I'm fairly easy to find.
Awesome. Well, thanks again, Dr. Talani. We really appreciate you being with us, and a big thank you to our NextPod listeners. Remember, you are the future. Join us next month for another in-depth talk.